Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of May 8th, 2015. That's the music from the movie Bullet, the 1968 classic starring Steve McQueen as a cop who plays by his own rules and gets in too deep. Yeah, one of those. It's got a plot and characters and such, but there's one thing that makes it legendary. That car chase with that music through the streets of San Francisco. And sometimes that's what happens in our lives. Everything else disappears, and there's just the chase. This is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. On today's show, the chase. What we chase in our careers, our economy, and our financial lives. So what are you chasing in yours? Let us know by visiting marketplace.org and clicking on Go. You can tell us on Facebook or tweet us. We're at Marketplace WKND. Our first story of the chase today grew out of an exploration of the glass ceiling on last week's show. You can see our first guest this week on Netflix if you stream the documentary Anita. She is, of course, Professor Anita Hill, and that documentary follows her role in Justice Clarence Thomas's 1991 Supreme Court confirmation hearings when she accused him of sexual harassment. Since then, Hill has taught about harassment, women's studies, and workplace diversity. She's now at Brandeis University, where she's a professor of social policy, law, and women's studies. And as we thought about the glass ceiling, we wondered what Anita Hill and other working women are still chasing, 24 years after the hearings that first introduced her to the public. Professor Hill, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I noticed in this documentary, Anita, that is being released on Netflix now, there is a scene in which young girls are asked if they know who you are. And I'm wondering how you want them to know who you are.
I want them to know who I am as a person who truly believes in equality and who is dedicating her life really to the pursuit of equality, whether it's gender equality or racial equality, or really, as we say now, the combination.
How does that translate, do you think, into economic life for women or beyond that, when we look at, say, how women are paid or whether or not sexual harassment suits actually succeed?
We now understand that the laws against sexual harassment really are about women's ability to work and perform and achieve economically and socially in the workplace and in the marketplace. And so we don't really separate out sexual harassment from economic equality. Those things go hand in hand.
You wrote an essay for Fortune after the Ellen Pao trial saying that the sunlight is beginning to do its work, quoting Justice Brandeis. I'm a little skeptical of that. Is it? I mean, she lost.
Ellen Pao did lose her case, but that doesn't mean that there isn't some value in it. I'll use my own example. In 1991, when I testified, people concluded that I had lost. Nevertheless, in the years that followed my testimony, more and more women came forward to claim that they had been harassed and discriminated against in their workplaces. So just knowing what harassment was, what discrimination is and was, increased the number of complaints. And I suspect that's what's going to happen in this situation. I believe it's going to encourage more people to come forward and bring their suits.
We are talking about the idea of the chase, sort of writ broadly in our show this week. And I'm wondering, what do you feel like you've been chasing since 91?
The chase to really understand what gender equality means in 2015 or in the 21st century. How does it truly get played out, particularly in the workplace? We now, for example, businesses and business schools encourage collaboration. You can't have collaboration, true collaboration, if everyone comes in with the same background and the same perspective. And you can't have true collaboration if some ideas and some perspectives are privileged over others. Mm. So we now have a mounting evidence that when women are included, that the decisions that are made are better. They're more effective, they're more efficient, and in the long run, they benefit employers.
You're the expert now, but you were the example. Your life was flayed open. Was that worth it?
Well, it was worth it in the long run, I think, because as I've said, a lot of people have come forward since then. And I'm fortunate to hear from people who say that they came forward because of my example. But I think it's always worth it to have the truth come forward and to have our stories out in the public, and to have these large public conversations that include the reality of our experiences. We're not going to get to our goal of equality by hiding women's experiences, whatever the particular outcome of an incident is, whether it's the POW decision or what happened to me in 1991 with the Senate Judiciary Committee. The important thing in the long run is that it opens up the dialogue and it allows more people to come forward.
I was in high school in Washington, D.C. in 1991, and I remember watching you literally be chased through Senate office buildings. I am wondering what it is like to have your name forever associated with Justice Thomas. After all, I'm asking you these questions 24 years after the fact.
It's interesting that you say that my name is associated with Justice Thomas. That is in part true. But in reality, my name is more associated with the issues. The issue of gender equality, women in the workplace, sexual harassment. And what I like to think is that if my name is associated with progress toward equality, toward ending sexual harassment, I'm okay with that.
Joe Biden led the questioning on the Senate Judiciary Committee. He's the vice president now. Did he fail you?
I think the way the hearing was conducted failed not only me, but it failed the American public.
But the vice president in particular?
Well, he ran the hearings, and I'll leave you to conclude whatever you would like about that. It was his job to run the hearings. We have to look at how the hearings were run, whether they were aimed at getting to the truth or whether they were aimed at just getting it done with so that we could move on. But I think what is really important is that as we look back on those hearings, there are lots of examples of what we need to do now, whether it is a thorough investigation of complaints, whether it is conducting hearings so that both sides are able to come forward and not have their testimony judged by myth, but by facts and evidence.
You know, one of the things that I wonder, because we have seen, obviously, you're extremely successful now, what were the personal economic ramifications like after coming forward and then trying to move on?
Well, there were decisions that I had to make after 1991 and after the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings. For example, my tenured job at the University of Oklahoma was threatened publicly by state officials who wanted to remove my tenure, revoke my tenure. The pressure that was put on me to be quiet afterward and sort of disappear, I believe, had an impact on me economically. But it also had an impact on my colleagues, and the culture and climate in which I was working changed dramatically after 1991. And so I had to make some decisions to move on to another workplace so that I could really live and work fully and freely in an environment that valued my voice.
I am curious what it is like for you now to see a black woman confirmed as the Attorney General of the United States.
I'll start back with 1992 when Carol Moseley Braun was confirmed as the first African-American woman who became a senator in the U.S. Senate. That was monumental, and my mother and I shared that experience, and she was so thrilled to see that in her lifetime. My mother is now deceased, and it's almost 24 years later, and we are seeing the first African-American woman attorney general. I say it's about time. I celebrate it, and I hope that what it does is open up the opportunities for others.
Why do you think there is a moment now where there is so much interest in your story?
Without sounding too egotistical, I believe there's been an interest in the story for 24 years. I talk to people who say, I can remember exactly where I was when I heard your testimony. Now, I'm also hearing from younger women, maybe they didn't have any understanding of what was happening in October of 1991 in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. But now they're saying, I'm in the workplace now, and I understand exactly what your experience was about and why it was important. So I believe that the interest has been ongoing, and it's growing as more and more young women get into the workplace.
Professor Anita Hill, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Today, we're looking at what we chase in an economic sense. But before we get back to that, let's look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks those figures and serves them up at marketplace.org. Here's our digital producer, Tony Wagner, with this week's numbers.
Thanks, Lizzie. Here's our first number.
250.
At least that many businesses were damaged or completely destroyed during riots in Baltimore. A couple of them were CVS stores. The good news is they're slated to reopen. CVS plays an important role in West Baltimore neighborhoods. It's one of the few places where residents can get prescription medication and fresh produce.
$32 billion.
That's the size of the U.S. organic food market. The Washington Post reports an increasing number of major food conglomerates are investing in organic brands, sometimes quietly to avoid alienating consumers. Some say the investment benefits the still small business of organic farming. Others say large companies could use their influence to lower the threshold of what's considered organic.
0.5%
is how far the S&P 500 fell Wednesday after Fed Chair Janet Yellen commented that stock prices were, quote, quite high. Her comments were measured, but she did say there was some danger of volatility when the Fed eventually raises short-term interest rates.
Thanks, Tony. And we'll have more about what Janet Yellen said and those market highs later in the show. Now, we're going to stay with our chase theme when we talk about how, every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
Okay, this week we are talking about stingrays.
Yes.
The electronic thing, not the SeaWorld thing.
Landborne or airborne, not waterborne, at
Correct.
Least so far as we know.
Okay, so why are we talking about them this week? What are these things?
A stingray is a device that basically mimics a cell phone tower in order to connect to nearby cell phones. If you've ever heard or seen police scanners, they look kind of similar. It's about actually suitcase-sized. They've been used in airplanes and mounted on cars or simply put near cell phone towers, and they're used by law enforcement to track people who the law enforcement agents think are committing a crime or about to commit a crime or something like that. So it basically tricks your cell phone signal into jumping into the stingray instead of the tower.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives law enforcement, you know, phone ID, activity, and location information. And the reason we're talking about them is that they're being used more and more by local police departments to track or chase suspected criminals. The FBI has reportedly also used them to track suspected terrorists.
And this week, kind of a big deal.
A big deal because the Justice Department just announced it was conducting a review of Stingray's use. we know very little about how these things are being used and how widely they're being used. The FBI has actually made police department members sign non-disclosure agreements about using them. And it's a new kind of data collection in a way. And so it's easier for law enforcement to conduct, and people are increasingly not happy about that.
Bringing our tech and real life theme into focus, could my data or your data, you know, I'm walking around talking on my cell phone, can that get swept up by a stingray?
It actually can very easily. The way that these things work, as we said, is they trick nearby phones into going to the stingray and pinging the stingray instead of pinging the cell phone tower that they're sort of mimicking. And if you're in the same location as a person, or is the same sort of radius of a cell phone tower that another person that law enforcement is tracking is, your data could get swept up. Chances are your data will get caught up if you're close to somebody who is being tracked by the government in this way. A recent test conducted over a two-day period driving around Washington, D.C., revealed 18 separate supposedly possible stingrays in the city.
So we're in this big moment where people are thinking about data collection at a federal level or as people on an individual level. Let's talk about the value of this, because we're still thinking economically. Should I care that companies are placing a value on my data and collecting it?
The way that I would look at this, Lizzie, is that this is a little bit different than a company. A company certainly puts value on your data.
Right.
That's why companies like Google and your wireless provider collects this information, holds it for certain amounts of time. In the eyes of the government, value, I guess there's a different question there, or a different idea of what value really is. It's very valuable to the FBI to stop an act of terrorism, for instance, and that's what law enforcement argues it is trying to do when it's using stingrays.
And yet this week, a big ruling.
Yes, there was also a big ruling this week in a New York federal appeals court that said that the bulk collection of cell phone data that is part of the Patriot Act, which is actually some parts of this are about to expire on June 1st, was illegal. And this is a really big deal, because moving through Congress right now are pieces of legislation that would actually scale back some of that surveillance. So there's a big debate happening right now about how law enforcement of all kinds collects data on cell phone users. And in the case of stingrays, this might actually change the way that people use stingrays, even though we don't actually know that much about how people use them now.
Moving forward, how much do we know about what is being done with our data and what will be done with our data? It's, this stuff is like gold for some companies and some parts of the government.
You know, I think the issue that we keep running into is it's evolving all the time. I mean, the way that both companies and the government is using our data is evolving all the time. The relationships between companies and government and how that data is collected,
and how much we know about it,
is evolving all the time. And also, Lizzie, the technology is advancing all the time. And so it becomes this kind of like constant game of catch up, whether you're a user or the government trying to regulate this kind of thing, or law enforcement trying to catch the bad guys, so to speak. I mean, it's never ending.
I feel like we're probably going to have you back to talk more about this as this moves through Congress.
I wouldn't be surprised if we talked about it again.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Last week, we asked you what you're chasing in your own financial lives. For some people, it's a new job or a promotion. Others are looking for better ways to save or faster ways to retire. So we brought in Lauren Lyons Cole, a certified financial planner. She's also the host of the new show, The Financial Fix, at thestreet.com. She's here to talk about chasing financial goals, whether you're in your 20s or your 60s. Welcome back, Lauren.
Thanks for having me, Lizzie.
Our theme this week is the chase, and people chase a lot of very different financial goals. So when you think about that on a large level, are there any kind of good rules of thumb when you are kind of setting your own goals?
Well, the great thing about saving is if you have goals, it's a lot easier to work hard towards doing that, right? You're much more motivated to cut back on spending when there's a reason to do it.
Instead of just like amorphous whatever.
Right, which, yeah, there's no real reason to save in that case. So I would say it's really important to have an extra cash cushion. A lot of people call this the emergency fund. That really has to come first, which is a little bit of a bummer because it's the least fun thing to save for. But you want to have something, you know, at least aim for two paychecks worth to start with and build up from there. Get to $10,000 and try to keep going. But you've also got to balance retirement. If you're trying to save for a house, you've got to balance that too. But make sure you have cash on hand just in case you need it.
One of the issues that comes up is flexibility. So say retirement was what you thought you were saving for, but then you want to go back to school or whatever it is. You want to have a baby. Are there flexible ways to save that give you the room to do that?
Well, you know, having money is all about making choices, and you want to make sure you're living the life you want to live. So, of course, we want to retire and we want to be safe and happy when we get to that stage of life. But if you didn't have the child you wanted or if you didn't achieve the career goals you wanted, you're not going to be as happy. So it's important to take advantage of the time that you have. But for instance, let's talk about education. Don't just go back to school and use your retirement savings to put towards that goal unless you have a very clear path and a clear analysis of the return on investment. So if you're going to spend money on education, make sure you're going to earn that money when you graduate.
And are there different kinds of accounts that give you, say, more flexibility than less?
So a Roth IRA is always a great account. That's kind of my go-to. It's my favorite account. With a Roth IRA, you can save for retirement and you save with money that's contributed on an after-tax basis. So when you get to retirement, you can take that money back out without having to pay taxes on it again, which is a really big point to make. The other good thing about a Roth IRA is you can withdraw your contributions at any time. So if you've been contributing and you decide you want to go back to school or you want to buy a house, that is accessible money. Not that I'm recommending taking it out, but you could, in theory, take out the contributions.
So it just gives you a little more wiggle room.
Definitely, right. It's the most flexible account that exists, basically.
We had a listener write in about chasing retirement. He said, right now I'm chasing a better savings so that my wife and I can continue to enjoy our time together while planning to have a kid. I think if you grew up in a certain era, you were used to a savings account or maybe a CD being a thing that gave you a safe and decent return. Under the current Federal Reserve policy, interest rates are really low. So how can you have that kind of safety but also actually earn some money?
So here's the thing. The only real way to beat inflation is to have your money invested in the stock market. And that is a scary concept for a lot of people. You know, historically, the stock market has returned 8% on average per year. But what we forget is very rarely does the stock market actually return 8% in a single year. It's often it's up 30%. It's down 30%. We have big swings. But if you have your money there and if you know your time horizon, you can be confident that you're going to stay ahead of inflation. So it's important to not be afraid of investing in the stock market.
That's something we've seen with millennials who save a lot of money but don't actually invest.
Millennials are actually doing a great job of saving. We've definitely seen that. But they're intimidated by the stock market. There's a lack of trust there.
And which makes sense if you came of age in the middle of the financial crash.
Nobody can blame them, that's for sure. But what we really want to do is have them have their money working for them, especially young millennials. They need to have their money invested. They have the time to take on the risk.
One of the questions we have is sort of about pacing, right? Is this a fast chase, a slow chase? Does slow and steady always win out if you're thinking 30-year time horizon, or are there moments when it makes sense to have a 5-year horizon, a 2-year horizon?
I think we forget that money and income, our lifetime doesn't just go up in a nice, easy trajectory. Some years are better than others. Anyone who's self-employed definitely understands that concept. But all of us, I mean, it really applies to everybody, that on years where you're doing really, really well, that's when you want to sock away as much as possible to know that some years, you know, it's cyclical. Not all years are going to be so good. So you want to give yourself the leeway, I guess. So, you know, one year you might save 25% and the next year you might only be able to save 0%. But over time, that's going to work out to your advantage.
So some speeding up, some slowing down, it actually makes a little sense?
It's really the only way to do it, honestly. I mean, at the end of the day, if that's what you're doing what everybody else is doing.
So to make this a little more personal, I am curious what your goals have been and if they've shifted, how they've shifted.
Well, one thing I think that has always been consistent for me is retirement has always been my number one priority. As long as I'm maxing out my available retirement accounts, I feel pretty good about saving for fun things on the side. So in my 20s, I spent all of my extra savings on travel, which is something I don't regret at all. I absolutely, those trips are priceless. And now that I'm in my 30s, my priorities are a little bit different. Now I'm more interested in saving for bigger goals. But that's a good thing. And I think money really represents choice. So whatever your goals are at whatever stage of life, and we're all on our own journeys, focusing on don't forget about retirement, don't forget about the responsibilities, but then giving yourself the motivation to save for things that are more enjoyable is really important as well.
Lauren Lyons-Cole is a personal finance contributor to TheStreet.com and a frequent guest here. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Now we're turning to a literal chase, a race. We're talking about auto racing in Kuwait. Kuwait was the first Gulf country to grow a motor racing industry, but over time, that prominence decayed, and the last major track there closed a few years ago. These days, Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates host prestigious Formula One races, but Kuwait is trying to make a comeback. Jonathan Fruin, one of our partners at the BBC, went there and has this story.
That is the sound of a drag racer storming down a track. The car is owned by Sadek Taki, a Kuwaiti who owns a whole racing team. He says motor racing is in Kuwaiti's blood.
When we got down to Bahrain, Qatar, Abu Dhabi, any place, any track in this district, 80% of the cars that go on racing this week from Kuwait.
He and his friends spend all their spare money on drag racing, and his cars have seen success. But these days, he has to take them to places like Qatar in order to compete. And Sadek reckons it's about time Kuwait built another track.
Imagine a football player with no soccer field. How can I play? Right? I mean, it's senseless. It don't make any sense. So the greatest support from the government would be give us a track. Let us race in our own backyard.
Kuwait has a heritage of motor racing dating back to 1974, but its main track closed a decade ago after complaints from local residents about the noise and smell.
You can see the Kuwaitis love the cars.
Sports journalist Osama Al-Mansour gives me a tour of the Kuwait Classic Cars Museum, full of vintage Rolls-Royce, Porsche and other prestigious models. He reckons that government bureaucracy is holding back a decision to support Kuwaiti motorsports, but that an investment in the sector would quickly reap dividends in terms of victories for the country.
Everyone knows that Kuwait's a rich country. There's nothing stopping the government taking action like forming teams. If we want to look at examples, there's Qatar. They have a rally driver who's been Middle East champion more than 8 times. He has full support from the government in Qatar. And here in Kuwait, we have talents and we had our achievements, so we can easily achieve this.
That's the sound of a Porsche being put through its paces. And last year, the small track it's racing around was opened by a philanthropist. It wouldn't be big enough to host a major race, but offers a venue for kart racing, and car dealers can offer test drives to potential buyers. Zakaria Dashti, the SIRB Circuit's executive manager, says one of the founders' hopes is that it might inspire the government to think about building a much bigger circuit too.
Officials from all over the governmental sectors in Kuwait are coming to realize what benefit a small track can do. Now imagine what a bigger benefit that would a bigger, more multi-track and multitask track would do to the country in terms of social, in terms of economy, in terms of raising the awareness.
It looks like it'll be quite some time before motor racing enthusiasts in Kuwait get the high-speed, full-size track that they're so keen to enjoy. In the meantime, they'll have to console themselves with that small track. Plus, alongside it, there is a tiny track, complete with miniature cars, traffic lights and road signs, aimed at kids as young as 7 or 8 to teach them the rules of safe driving on the road.
That's the BBC's Jonathan Fruin. In next week's show, we're talking about transactions, and we need your help. We've all looked at a bill or a receipt and thought, 15 cents for what? Or a landing fee? A $2.95 convenience fee? What is that? We are putting together a collection of crazy transaction fees and charges, and we want yours. So if you want to play, take a picture of your bill or receipt, put it on Instagram, and tag us. We're at Marketplace APM. And, of course, don't forget to cover up your personal information. And now, continuing our theme of the chase, chasing a high. And so far this year, the markets have been on a big old high. Heady, breathless, intoxicating. So much so that Fed Chair Janet Yellen warned about those highs this week. This analogy, comparing markets to booze and drugs, is not mine. It is Patty Hirsch's. He's responsible. Patty is our resident explainer here at Marketplace, and I've asked him to come in and explain himself. Hi, Patty.
Hey, Lizzie.
All right, explain yourself. Stock market as a drug? Come on, man. What's up with that?
You may mock me, but when I watch the way investors are behaving these days, it makes me think of them like a bunch of wasters getting stupid on the fumes of the market as it roars higher and higher.
Can you translate that into American speak?
It means, you know, market's doing really, really well, right? And you've got a bunch of, you know, investor drug addicts sucking on the tailpipe as it, you know, roars through the roof. It's crazy. It's craziness. They're all nuts.
Okay, so as we watch the market go up and up, is this a cause for legit celebration?
Well, it is if you're an investor, because it means your asset prices are going up, right? But let's not forget that barely half of Americans are invested in the stock market in any way, not even through 401ks. So the soaring market is not really benefiting the majority of the country. And I would argue that it's not really benefiting the economy much either. I mean, so the stock market's up around 13% over the last 12 months and up more than 70% over the last 5 years. That is pretty spectacular, given, you know, this where we were 5 years ago. But the economy's recovery has not been quite so spectacular, right? I mean, we saw at last the first estimate of first quarter GDP is like 0.2% growth, so not that great. Now, it's true that wages are beginning to rise, but they're not really rising that much. The house market is still bumbling along. People still have to work several jobs to make ends meet. They still have to use food stamps to supplement their income. You know, things are not so great on the ground where most of America lives.
And this really echoes a phrase that we use a lot, which is, you know, the economy is not the stock market. The stock market is not the economy.
Yeah.
Why do so many people equate the two?
Well, I just think they think, you know, they look at what the stock market's doing. They think, oh, wow, things must be doing really well in America right now because the stock market's doing so well. And that's just not the case. The stock market is a projection of what things are going to be like in the future. It's a bet. People, when they put money into the stock market, they're doing it because they expect those stocks to rise over the next 6 months or so, so that in the future, they'll be worth more than they are now. So they're betting. What we're seeing now is that investors and companies are chasing this heady narcotic of shareholder value, as opposed to, if you want, the natural endorphin high of genuine growth, right? And if you look at the numbers that we saw coming out of companies this earnings season, they're hoarding huge amounts of cash, right? Qualcomm, $29.6 billion. Yahoo, $41.2 billion. Microsoft, $107.4 billion. Apple, $194 billion.
That's a lot of watches.
That's a lot of watches, although I hear they had to fix one, right, the other day. But this isn't money that's going into the kind of growth that creates jobs and builds new businesses. This is money that they're using to pump up the stock price through dividend payments and share buybacks. So in other words, the investors who are running after these companies aren't chasing genuine long-term growth. They're chasing the fumes that come out of the rise in the stock market and nothing more.
Back to that fumes thing. So, okay, let's push this analogy a little bit, because if they're chasing fumes, that never actually works out that well, does it?
That's true. And, you know, admittedly, if we're going to extend this and talk about withdrawal and all the rest of it, in order to experience withdrawal, you've got to quit the drug, right? And investors are certainly not going to quit on their own. They're not going to want to give up those great dividends or the increases in the stock price that comes from share buybacks. But companies may wean them off that drug, right? Because if they decide to quit that kind of a behavior, if they stop paying dividends so much or stop these buybacks, as a lot of investors are now starting to suggest they do, it would be better for the economy in the long run, right? Because they'd be channeling money into the growth of the economy as opposed to chunking up the stock price.
But do you think going forward, we could actually see companies chase real growth? And if you do, because I'm skeptical, name me a couple of companies.
Well, I think you might start to see a company like Apple, for example, which has this huge, massive amount of money, $194 billion, people are estimating based on their last earnings report. I think you'll see a company like that, once they get more confident, firstly, about the growth of the global economy and, you know, prospects for investments in other countries, you'll start to see them doing things like buying other companies in other countries. You'll start to see them expanding into new markets. You'll start to see them expanding into new products, which also means, of course, not necessarily new markets physically, but new markets in terms of people's ability to buy certain things.
But would they do something like, say, pay actual staff wages and benefits to a lot of their service workers instead of contractors? You know, that would change their stock price, certainly.
That would certainly change their stock price. And I don't see any reason why they shouldn't do that. I mean, there's, you know, people are now pushing for those kinds of changes and pushing for those kinds of reforms. And if Apple believes that it's going to get money in eventually, then we'll start to make those capital investments. And I think maybe even start changing the way it pays people. I think you will start to see them making these changes in the way they spend their money and investing more specifically in the long-term economy.
Patty Hirsch, our resident explainer and the host of our Whiteboard series. Thanks, Patty.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Sometimes we chase our career ambitions thousands of miles away from home. You want to be an actor? Move to LA. You want to make it in finance? New York. Chad Radford is a music editor for the alt-weekly Creative Loafing, and he explains why the music scene in Atlanta draws people from all over. But Chad isn't a musician, and nor is he from Atlanta.
No, I grew up in Iowa, and after I graduated from the University of Iowa with a degree in journalism, I was looking for a place to basically start over and really get a career going. And I always knew that I wanted to write about music. And one of the first things I discovered was Prefuse 73. Which was just, I mean, it was exactly what I was looking for. This kind of hybrid of hip-hop, electronic music, and the avant-garde. And just sort of stumbled onto this entire scene that existed around it. I mean, most of it's long gone at this point. We're talking about 1999 here. You know, I just decided to move here out of the blue. I'd never been here. I knew nothing about it. And I figured there's this really rich music scene there. I don't see anybody who's really even tapped into it. And it sort of exists outside of a lot of the trends and a lot of the things that you would get in a place like New York or Los Angeles. So I came here. I do, like, continually encounter people who have moved here just specifically for music. Everybody who is here in the music scene is kind of from somewhere else. Well, since I've lived in Atlanta, and I'm talking about a period of about 1999 until now, there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of bands that have sort of come up. Some of the more popular ones, or the ones that have gone on to find success, would be Deer Hunter.
Take my hand and pray with me.
The Black Lips.
Back in Orlando, back in.
Mastodon.
I can see what the world has done to you.
There are so many different levels to the music scene here. Like, in the hip-hop world, you know, when I moved here, I remember there were two names that people were always talking about when it came to hip-hop. It was Outkast.
One, two, three.
And the Micronauts were another one. And the Micronauts were kind of coming from a different scene.
Welcome to the Empire. My words been fire. We sell food, so we call it self-sire. When we hire for the show, we bless the crowd like Chaya, inspired in tune. We know we desire disrespect.
They started to get some success there for a while, but then I don't really know whatever happened to them. Outkast went on to become Outkast. They were already Outkast by the time I moved here in 99. Trap wasn't even a word that people used when you talked about music back then, at least that I knew of. So that entire genre has developed over time. Lil Jon was big for a long time here. And he's still kind of around. People still run into him. Dylan Von Maurer is this really fascinating rapper who you could file under comedian, you can file him under philosopher, you can file him under master chef. He moved here from Jacksonville, Florida, and has really established himself on the local hip-hop scene, on the underground hip-hop scene. People do still come here to sort of find themselves in the musical world.
Wait, no. What's this?
Don't look at that.
The Atlanta Lobster Festival.
I didn't want
and
you to see that.
Nobody tells me. Lobby Don Peak.
I know.
This is the worst day of my lob life.
I'm sorry, dude.
This is not a test. How you gonna blacklist Lobster Domus from the Atlanta Lobster Fest?
We started the show today with music from a movie with a famous car chase. But if you turn on TV news, especially in, say, California or Florida, you're maybe likely to find the real thing. Televised police chases. We wanted to figure out why they're such a draw for newsrooms, for viewers, and for the people who sometimes regard them like a live-action video game, even though the stakes are much higher and can be fatal, which happened live on TV in Texas in April when a man was shot by police. We're turning to Al Tompkins. He's worked around TV newsrooms for over 40 years and now teaches journalism at the Poynter Institute. Hi, Al.
Hi.
How did this become a thing, a part of our sort of colloquial understanding of what goes on TV news?
In 1998 and 1999, there were some pretty horrific incidences that happened in California. In 98 in Los Angeles, there was a man who took his own life on TV. Then in San Diego in 99, there was a person who died in a chase that ended in a shootout. And in both cases, television said, you know what, we ought to rethink this. We ought to rethink about whether we air these things live. And then they just kept on doing it because they were, you know, they were ratings magnets. First of all, we had helicopter technology and microwave technology that allowed them to go live. The pictures from the television cameras were amazing because there was an image stabilization camera that allowed you to zoom in from far away in ways that you couldn't do if it was a shoulder-held camera. So lots of things happened. There was opportunity, there was transmission, there was the visual, and by the way, a huge amount of airtime to fill on cable that
right.
couldn't always be filled with actual news. So all of these things sort of made a witch's brew of opportunity, and this was just one thing that was born of it.
Do we know how much it costs a station to put one of these things on the air?
Well, it's expensive. There's no doubt about it. But journalism often is expensive. The cost of putting a helicopter up is in the hundreds of dollars per half hour. But that's just the beginning of the cost. You also have the cost of the pilot, the cost of the airtime. If you're interrupting commercials, that's
right.
money.
What's the return to a station for televising one of these?
Well, there are a couple of returns. One, the short term, obviously, is probably the overnight ratings. Another might be to build your reputation that whatever's going on, we're there, we're on top of it. We can bring it to you live. And we have to also acknowledge that there is also this public service that could come if you're covering something that's truly newsworthy. Now, if all you're doing is taking in a feed from another city and it doesn't affect people, then I think there's an actual cost, not necessarily a benefit. Cost to your reputation that you're just sort of there as a vulture and you'll air anything that's graphic that ends, you know, in bloodshed.
But theoretically, there's also a financial return, right, if viewers flock to these things?
Ratings equal money. There's no doubt about that. That if you can consistently generate ratings, then advertisers are more interested in advertising with you, in theory, because you'll reach more people. But an individual event isn't very saleable. That is to say, nobody's going to say, look, if you happen to have a car chase and that car is going to end up in a crash, I am a used car dealer and maybe people will be interested in that. Or maybe what they'll want is a faster car. So I sell fast cars and I'll advertise on you. Just make sure you stick me in there somewhere if there's another car chase. Nobody does that. So it's not an instant payoff. What you're doing is reputation building. For better or worse, you're reputation building when you cover these things.
So talk me through making this decision. You're in a newsroom. You know this thing is happening. You don't have long to react.
You don't have long to react, which is why you ought to practice. You ought to think about this prior to it happening. Once you've decided to go there, it seems to me you have to ask a series of questions of yourself. One, Is this so important that you're willing to air the worst possible outcome? Because if the answer to that is no, you better have another plan, whether that plan is a delay, which is possible, totally possible. It's totally possible to have a live signal come back to a television station and put it on a tape delay, whether it's 5 seconds, 10 seconds, or 30 seconds. It's totally possible. And yet station after station, network after network doesn't do it. So it's just one of those mystifying things. Why don't they do it? Well, it's cumbersome. It's troublesome. It probably is going to be okay. We'll have a quick finger. We won't get caught. This doesn't look like that kind of thing. Well, you know what? You just never know.
So if you look forward, stations stream on the internet. There are so many different journalistic outlets. Is this going to change at all, do you think?
Well, I would have thought 10 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago, the answer would have been yes. But here we are. All these years later, almost 20 years after the first noteworthy one, and no, nothing much has changed at all.
Al Tompkins is a senior faculty member at the Poynter Institute. Thank you so much for talking with us.
You're sure welcome.
We're going to end this show on a story of a career chase. We heard from Anita Hill about women at work at the top of the show. Now we're going to meet a young woman just starting out in the workforce. Marketplace senior reporter Mitchell Hartman met her at an engineering and computer science job fair this spring at the University of Portland. Her name is Lupita Carabas, and she's a 22-year-old senior there. She's majoring in electrical engineering and minoring in computer science. She told Hartman she not only stands out because she's the first in her family to get a college degree, but also because she calls herself a...
quadruple threat, because I have the EECS. I'm a woman and I'm Latina.
And so you've gotten your first job. Let's hear about it.
I do. I scored a job for IBM as a software security engineer in Boston. So I'll be heading out there in June of this summer.
You're a little bit surprised.
Yeah, I am a little bit surprised. Just, where I come from, sort of what I've been able to accomplish is something I didn't, see myself being here where I'm at today. So,
do you like hard work?
I do. I work very hard, and I challenge myself to the fullest. I try to make the most of, the opportunities that are out there.
And just tell us briefly about your family.
So my father is originally from Guadalajara, Jalisco, and my mom is from Michoacán, and neither of them have any education, not even elementary school. So I am the first to attend elementary, middle, high, and university.
So they're a little proud of you. Do they kind of get it?
At first, they definitely did not get it. They did not understand the level of, difficulty that I was facing in some of my courses or, the material and stuff. But now they, that I'm coming to a close, they're finally understanding, the complexity and some of the challenges that I've had to overcome. So.
Wow. Sounds like you probably overcome a few more.
Yeah. It's been quite the challenge, but it's been a fun one.
And that's our show for the week. Next week, we're talking transactions. And you know those transaction fees? We want to see them. So send us pictures of your craziest fees by posting a snapshot of your bill or receipt to Instagram. After you do that, tag us with @MarketplaceAPM. Please don't forget to cover up your personal information. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills. Dan Simatovich is our senior producer. Our engineer is Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks so much for listening. This is APM.